So Luke 9 and starting at verse 37. The next day, when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. A man in the crowd called out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child. A spirit seizes him and he suddenly screams. It throws him into convulsions so that he foams at the mouth. It scarcely ever leaves him and is destroying him. I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not." "You unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." Even while the boy was coming, the demon threw him to the ground in a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the impure spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. While everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he said to his disciples, "Listen carefully to what I am about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men." But they did not understand what this meant. It was hidden from them, so that they did not grasp it, and they were afraid to ask him about it.
Please do keep your Bibles open at that page so we can look at it together. Libby, thank you very much for reading it out for us. I've given this a title, Trusting Jesus in Hard Times, from Luke 9. I want to focus just on verses 37 to 43. It's one thing to trust Jesus in good times. It's another thing to trust him in hard times. And it is great, isn't it, that God does give us good times in our life, in our faith, times when God seems very real and powerful and we feel encouraged and we feel very sure about him. Perhaps you can remember times like that in your life. Perhaps when you first became a Christian and it was all new and fresh and exciting. Or perhaps there have been times when you've had great answers to prayer. Perhaps you like to go away to a big Christian conference or celebration or retreat. Maybe a summer camp or a mission where God is very clearly at work and it's exciting to be part of it. Perhaps you can think of times when you've looked up at the stars maybe, or out over an amazing view, a sort of mountaintop experience of God's presence. And we can trust God at times like that, and it's helpful that we have them. But we're also called to trust Jesus when times are not like that, when answers to prayer seem a long time coming, when we feel that temptation is really getting the better of us, when we're facing disappointments or discouragements, when our little corner of the cause of Christ seems to be suffering some setbacks, some steps backwards, some decline. At times like that, it's easy to feel that God is remote, that he's far above us, that he's far away, that he doesn't know what it's like for us and how it is for us. Well, we're at the end now of our look at Luke's Gospel. We've been looking at it over the last few months at 10:30. And I hope it's already been a great encouragement to you and has helped you to trust Jesus. We saw that it was written to make us certain of the things that we've been taught about Jesus. We saw that it's faith that saves us. Jesus says to people, "Your faith has saved you." So it's absolutely vitally important that we do trust Jesus and put our faith in him. We've seen that we rely on the eyewitnesses who heard from Jesus and passed on his message. But we're also seeing that they also needed help to trust Jesus. They also needed to learn that. And yes, Jesus gave them a mountaintop experience. There were times when they saw his glory. We were looking at one of those times last Sunday, it's called the Transfiguration. They went up a mountain and they saw Jesus. But there are also times when they saw Jesus down here in our mess, in our struggles, in our difficulties. So I want to start just with a very simple thought, which is that Christ came down. Christ came down. And actually, he does that in a very literal, practical way, doesn't he, at the beginning of our reading. Let me just read the first verse, chapter 9, verse 37. The next day, when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. Do you see, Luke is about to tell us another story, but he wants to remind us of the last story. He says, the next day, this is the day after the thing I was just talking about. Jesus has been up a mountain, he's coming down a mountain. Jesus took three of his closest followers away to pray. It was an overnight prayer meeting. It was literally a mountaintop experience of the glory of God. Peter, James and John see a glimpse of Jesus in all his power and majesty, and the reality of Jesus is uncovered for a moment, and they see him in dazzling brilliance, his divine glory, and they don't want it to stop. Do you remember that? Peter doesn't really want to come down the mountain. Well, we can understand that. He says, look, let's build some shelters. It's great to be here. He sees it's coming to an end. He says, no, it's great to be here. Let's stay. And we can understand that. Who would want to go back down to the crowds below that Jesus and the apostles have been dealing with, jostling and clamoring and pushing and shoving to try and get to Jesus with their desperate needs, their difficulties, their sicknesses, their illness, their grief, their shame, their isolation, all these things that Jesus has been dealing with. A massive seething crowd down there, 5,000 of them at one point. Who would want to be back down there? And yet, Jesus does come down. Back into that. In fact, he's just been saying that he is coming and he's on his way to Jerusalem where he's going to be rejected and suffer and be killed. He's just been talking about it. He's just about to talk about that again. Now, Jesus had no need to come into our world and do that. There's no obligation on him to do that. He can enjoy the glory of being the eternal Son of God in heaven. He can stay up the mountain where everything is good and right, but he comes down, not just in this sort of chapter of the Bible, but really, in a sense, that's a summary of his whole ministry, his whole mission in the world. We read that, didn't we, from Philippians 2, quick reminder of what we read in our first reading, Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage, rather he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant. This is who Jesus is. Christ came down into our mess and into our suffering. This is a picture of the earth taken from the moon by the Apollo 11 mission. We've been remembering that 50 years ago this week. And of course, to the astronauts, they look at the earth and they can just hold their thumb up and cover it over from where they're standing. And some of them speak about how small we are, how tiny, how insignificant. One of them, Colonel James Irwin, was so, he wasn't on the first mission to the moon, he was on Apollo 15, but he had the same experience. He came back and he really wanted to get to the bottom of all these things, and he ended up becoming very serious about his Christian faith. And he said the important thing is not that man walked on the moon, but that God walked on earth. The important thing is not that man walked on the moon, but that God walked on earth. That this tiny little insignificant planet, how tiny does it look to the infinite creator of the universe? The all-powerful divine Son in his glory. How small. And yet he became one of us. Came into our suffering, experienced our suffering, our rejection. Humiliated and put to death as a criminal on a cross. Christ came down. Christ came down to our suffering. To our suffering. Let me read on. I'm going to see what Christ came down to in these verses. Let me read on. Start again at verse 37. The next day, when Jesus came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. A man in the crowd called out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." A spirit seizes him and he suddenly screams. It throws him into convulsions so that he foams at the mouth. It scarcely ever leaves him and is destroying him. I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not. Can you see how desperate this man is? Can you hear the desperation in his voice? He doesn't ask Jesus to help. He begs Jesus to help. He says, look, just look at my son. All you need to do is look at him and your heart will go out to him and surely you'll want to help. Just see his suffering, his situation. Without warning, my son will just suddenly scream out of nowhere. He has fits, convulsions, seizures, foaming at the mouth. And this is happening to him all the time. It's scarcely ever okay. There are hardly a time when he's all right. And says the father, it is destroying him. And I'm sure it was. His body, showing the bruises or the scars. What was it doing to his mind, his personality? What was it doing to his future? How will he live? How will he work? How will he feed himself? He's an only child. Is this father thinking about the future? What will happen when I'm gone? What will happen when I'm not here to look after him? What will become of him then? And he begs Jesus, just as he begged the other disciples while Jesus was up at the top of the mountain with three of them, the others were down below, and already this man has tried asking them and begging them to help. But it must feel to him that no one is doing anything, no one can help, and nothing is changing. And parents will tell you that you're only as happy as your least happy child at any particular time in your week. And perhaps there are times for many parents when they just feel so helpless. That there's nothing they can do but watch. And that their child is being destroyed by something. Something that is not just suffering, but something that is just evil. And so I don't think we should be surprised to see that the Bible talks about this kind of suffering as the work of an evil spirit. Now, one reaction that people often have to this, and you can understand why they feel this way, is they read it and they say, well, maybe in those days when the Bible was written, maybe they just didn't know very much science, very much medicine. We now know that these are medical problems. We recognize this as epilepsy. Perhaps they didn't back then. Perhaps they came up with supernatural explanations because they didn't understand the physical medical explanations. But that doesn't really add up. Historians tell us that epilepsy was already widely known and recognized as an illness at the time the New Testament was written. Luke himself is a doctor and must have known that. In fact, medics today tell us that his description of epilepsy is accurate. You can recognize this. You could almost make a diagnosis just from his description of it here. And in fact, Matthew's gospel actually does say that this boy was epileptic and uses their word for epilepsy, as well as saying that this boy had a demon or an evil spirit. You see, the Bible doesn't deny that there is a physical medical explanation for our problems. It just says that there is also a spiritual, supernatural explanation that lies behind the physical world that we experience. After all, Genesis, right from the beginning of the Bible, tells us that Satan was at work from the start. He is the one who tempted humanity to disobey God and turn away from God and brought all the suffering and sickness into the world. It's not surprising to hear that Satan and evil spirits are still at work through suffering and sickness. We need to be careful, don't we, when we read the Bible, that we don't just jump to the conclusion that we modern people know more than the Bible does. You have to just sort of stop and think about it, and you realize that the whole point of the Bible is that God is speaking to us through it, and he knows a lot more than we do. And we're not coming to the Bible to correct it on where it's got things wrong. We're coming to the Bible to be corrected on where we've got things wrong. And where we tend to get things wrong in our modern society is we underestimate the reality of the supernatural and evil, and the Bible won't let us do that. And so you hear atheists saying passionately that evil is really just a biological thing. It's just an accident of evolution. It isn't really morally bad. You know, sickness and is not really a moral thing. Suffering is not really a moral thing. It just is. It's no, really, strictly speaking, it's neither better nor worse than not suffering. You hear atheists say it, but you listen to the tone of voice that they say it in. You listen to their anger and frustration about suffering and how opposed they are to it. And you realize it just can't be right. It can't be true. Sickness and suffering is a terrible thing. It is the result of evil. And the Bible is just pointing out something that we've forgotten. Christ came down to our suffering. And Christ came down to our unbelief, to our unbelief. Chapter 9, verses 40 and 41. Let me read that. I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not. You unbelieving and perverse generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? Bring your son here. Now, why can't the disciples drive out this demon? Really, they should be able to. If you were here a few weeks ago, you know that chapter 9, verse 1, Jesus gave them the power and the authority to drive out evil. And they've already been doing this in this chapter. So why can't they do it on this occasion? Jesus tells us in verse 41. He says, an unbelieving and perverse generation. Let's just look at that step by step. First, the unbelieving. The apostles don't believe they can. They have been given the power and authority of Jesus Christ to drive out evil, but they still struggle to believe in that power and authority of Jesus Christ. We saw that with the feeding of the 5,000. They've done some great miracles. They actually really don't think that Jesus is going to be able to feed all these people or that they can do it until Jesus overcomes their unbelief and works through them. Well, it's the same here. In the absence of Jesus, he's up in the mountain. They just don't believe it's going to happen. Unbelieving. But more than that, perverse. Jesus says unbelieving and perverse. Now sometimes it is reasonable to doubt some things. And other times it's really not reasonable, is it? So when mankind first set off for the moon in July 1969, some people found it hard to believe that humanity was really going to achieve this. And who can blame them? I mean, I'm told the technology on board the Apollo spacecraft was really no more advanced than you and I have in our washing machines at home today. And, you know, this is a society that is just about struggling to get toilets to come in from the outdoor toilets to indoor toilets and hasn't quite got the hang of colour TV. Is it really possible, they say to themselves, that humanity is going to land at the moon? It's not surprising, is it, at the time that people doubted it? Maybe that's reasonable. But what is not so reasonable is that still today, you occasionally come across people who still think it didn't really happen, and put together a sort of conspiracy theory, and say, you know, maybe the Americans were sort of showing off to the Russians and it's all fake photography. And it's not difficult to debunk that. I mean, there's so 50 years of evidence from those who were involved and those who were there and other spacecraft going past and taking photographs, even Russian spacecraft taking photographs of what they left behind. It has become really, to disbelieve it now, has become really perverse. You have to really want to think it's not true. And we're like that with Jesus Christ. That's what Jesus is saying. He's saying we're like that. Yes, sometimes it is reasonable to doubt, but certainly for these disciples who have seen it all and seen all the evidence and now know the reasons to believe, it's just become a bit perverse. There's something in human nature that doesn't want to believe in Jesus. Unbelieving, he says, perverse. And he says they're an unbelieving and perverse generation. The whole generation. So it's not just that the father didn't believe Jesus could do this at first, although we know that's true from Mark's account of this in Mark chapter 9. It's not just that the disciples didn't really believe that they could do it, although we know that that's true as well from Matthew's version of this in Matthew chapter 12. It's not just that. It's actually the whole generation. In fact, Jesus takes these words from the lips of Moses. In the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 32, Moses said the same thing about his generation. It's actually true of all of us. You might read the Gospels and say, well, the apostles are hopeless, so slow to be persuaded and to believe. Why on earth did Jesus choose them? But actually, they're no worse than anybody else. We all struggle. We all struggle to believe. We're living in a world with sort of twisted hearts that don't want to believe. And so Jesus says, well, how long must I stay among you? Christ came down into that. And he didn't find it easy. Before we say, well, Jesus sounds a little bit impatient here, a little bit grumpy here, we maybe just take a moment to think about it from his perspective. Here is the glory of the eternal divine Son coming into our world and enduring our unbelief. And how much of that will he have to put up with? Well, he's already told us that he will stay till the bitter end, when he's mocked and spat at and rejected and crucified. Christ came down to our suffering. Christ came down to our unbelief. And Christ came down to defeat evil. We're going to finish with that from verses 42 to 43. Christ came down to defeat evil. He did more than just feel for us. He did more than just share our experience. He did something about it. Chapter 9, verse 42. Even while the boy was coming, the demon threw him to the ground in a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the impure spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. What a wonderful outcome. The boy is healed. The impure spirit is rebuked. And that lovely little detail, he gave him back to his father. Jesus deals with the physical issue, the medical issue. He is healed. He deals with the spiritual, supernatural issue. The evil spirit is rebuked and sent away. And he deals with the emotional, relational issue. The boy is given back to his father. And as always in Luke, it's just a little picture of what Jesus does for each of us when he saves us. He doesn't do it immediately, but we know that this is the outcome of his work at the end of history. All our physical, medical problems dealt with, put right, new creation, new bodies, new resurrection bodies, all of our spiritual, supernatural issues dealt with, evil driven away from the world and from our lives once and for all. All the relational, emotional issues dealt with, relationships restored, brought back into love and security and community. And Jesus does all of this. He came to do all of this. And notice that he rebukes the evil spirit. He rebukes it. He hates evil and he condemns it. He tells it off. That's how Jesus sees sickness. Very different from atheism, saying, well, you know, it's just one of those things. It's just physical. It's not good or bad. This is one of the weaknesses, I think, of Buddhism and mindfulness. Now, people find Buddhist meditation and mindfulness helpful. Someone was telling me recently that he'd been advised by a Buddhist monk just to kneel down on a clear night in his garden and then look up at the stars. And he said he found it very helpful, just realizing how small his little problems are, getting them into perspective. And that is all that Buddhism and mindfulness can do for you. It can just make you feel that your suffering is not a big thing, that it's a small thing, that it's not that terrible. But actually, Jesus does something much better. He says, "I know how you feel, and I feel that way too. I hate your suffering." It could have been small to him. He's the infinite creator, but he cares about it, and he comes down into it. And he rebukes it. He says, that really is evil. That really is unacceptable. And I'm going to deal with it. And when he dies on the cross, he deals with evil. He takes away the power that evil has over our world. When he rises again, he does what is needed to fix it for good. Just look on at what the Bible goes on to say about this. This is later on in Luke's gospel. Jesus says, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." He goes on to say, "If I drive out demons by the finger of God, then the kingdom of God has come upon you." That's what it means when he gets rid of evil, that the eternal kingdom of God has come into this world through the arrival of Jesus. And then John, who is one of the disciples who witnesses all this, writes about it later. He says, "The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work." 1 John 3, verse 8. And the story that we read ends with all of them amazed by the greatness of God. The greatness of God is actually the same word that Peter uses when he's talking about the transfiguration in 2 Peter 1. Peter's talking about the transfiguration, the glory of God, the greatness of God has come down and dealt with evil. And people saw that. So will you and I trust Jesus in hard times? It won't be easy. But it will help us to realise that he came down, that he feels it, that he cares about it, that he's experienced it, that he knows it, and that he's defeated it. Let's put our trust in him.